Welcome to my humble home. I'd offer you a drink, but that seems to be an excessive courtesy, considering that you would like to see me dead. Dead is good. Better would be impoverished and in prison. He might not have been alone on the balcony. No one was visible through the tall windows, but there were areas she couldn't see. You don't look well, Mrs. Hawk. There's blood on your jacket. After pressing a button to activate the patrol eyes video cam that hung from her neck, she kept a two-hand grip on her pistol. He said,
Would you like me to call the paramedics?
No, Mr. Michael. I'll call them when you need them. He stood beside a Ruhlmann chair, a chunky block bergère buttered by the light from a Tiffany dragonfly motif floor lamp, in shades of yellow ranging from dark amber to lemon. The warm glow flattered him. A handsome, boyish-looking 44, with tousled blonde hair, he stood there in sneakers and jeans and untucked shirt, projecting his preferred image as a free spirit, a billionaire without pretensions. Of course, the sneakers were maybe by Tom Ford, the jeans by Dior Homme, the shirts by David Hart, a $3,000 ensemble, not counting the underwear. Just being in the same room with him left her feeling unclean, to see him looking her over as if considering her for aspasia. Tell me about the Tech Arcadians, Mr. Michael.
Sounds like some second-rate band. What do they play? Retro dance music from the 80s?
You're a smug son of a bitch, aren't you? But you'll talk.
How will you precipitate an interrogation, Mrs. Hawk? Zap me with a taser? Chloroform me? Strip me naked? Tie me with cable zips and tease my penis with a switchblade? Is that what you were taught back at Quantico? Hardly seems constitutional.
He cupped a hand to one ear.
Do you hear that?
She didn't want to play his game. Instead of answering his question, she said, Park your ass in that chair.
Do you hear that?
He repeated.
It's the future calling. It's a future you don't understand, and in which you have no role.
She would have liked nothing better than to kill him, with or without a confession.
Mrs. Hawk. Or should I say, Widow Hawk. No. You might find it painful to be addressed as such. Just Jane.
Jane. Because I know your type so very well. I'm sure you believe in the existence of a conscience, a little inner voice that tells you right from wrong. Because I know your type so very well, she said, I'm sure you don't. He moved away from the chair, toward a Suémar giltwood settee and matching armchairs, upholstered in an Aubusson tapestry. Moving with him, remaining peripherally aware of the open doors to the balcony, alert for movement elsewhere in the large room, Jane decided, for the moment, to let him do this his way, as it might lead to revelations more quickly than would an interrogation. He was such a narcissist, he no doubt believed that he could persuade her of the rightness of his position, and that even if he could not win her over, he would, by some unexpected twist of fate, overcome her. If only because destiny would always bend the course of events, bend the universe itself, to ensure a favorable result for DJ Michael.
You think a human conscience is essential for civilization to exist and remain stable, he said. Well, I propose to install just such a thing where it does not now exist. In a sense, we're allies.
He didn't sit in either the settee or one of the chairs, but stood, staring at a series of Ferdinand Price figurines that stood on the Ruhlmann coffee table, cold-painted, intricately costumed bronze dancers on marble and onyx bases, their faces and limbs of carved and tinted ivory. Jane's tinnitus grew louder, and she surveyed the room as if some musician might be seated in a corner playing a theremin. But of course the sound was internal, and again it faded.
When refined to perfection in a year or two, DJ Michael said, The ultimate nano-implant will rest so lightly within the skull that those graced with it won't have the slightest suspicion that their free will to do evil has been restrained. The decisions they make and the actions they take will seem always to be their choices. Their values and morals will be corrected with such subtlety that every change of opinion will seem to have been a product of their own reasoning. She said, "And you, just you, will decide what is evil, what's moral and what's not, what the right values are." Until he looked at her, she would not have thought that a smile could convey such acidic pity, such scalding contempt. Yet his voice remained soft and reasonable as he continued to speak this unreason. "Look at the world in all its horror, Jane, in all its chaos, war and injustice, bigotry and hatred, envy and greed, the codes of right and wrong that humanity has designed and endorsed. Have they ever worked, Jane? Are not all the codes misguided in one way or another, and therefore unworkable?" He moved away from the Suemar suit and turned his back to her, and went to a sideboard of Macassar ebony inlaid with mother-of-pearl, which was flanked by windows. He stood, gazing at a Tamara Lempicka portrait that hung above the sideboard, a stylishly dressed man portrayed against a backdrop of skyscrapers, all rendered in the artist's signature style, cold and painterly and powerful. He said, "Those graced with such an implanted conscience will never be troubled by doubt or guilt, because they will know that they are always doing the best and right thing. They will not know worry or restlessness of spirit. There will be nothing left in the world to fear." Arms weary, Jane had lowered the heckler. "You put it in such high-minded terms, but it sounds low and vile to someone who knows about the Aspasia girls, the Rayshaws, the cruelty with which you've used them." She raised the pistol again. "Sit the hell down." He returned to the bergère beside the Tiffany dragonfly lamp, but he did not obey her.
"There is no cruelty in what we've done, Jane. The world is full of people whose lives have no purpose. They wander through their meaningless existence, often in despair. We select those who are aimless and unhappy, and then we remove the reasons for their unhappiness and give them purpose. Or in the case of your husband, we remove those who are a threat to the future as it needs to be if the masses are to have a chance at contentment."
As earlier, the billionaire cupped a hand to one ear and stood as if listening to something inaudible to her.
"Do you hear destiny whispering, Jane?"
She squeezed off a shot, not at him but at the antique bergère. The upholstery on the chair split, and a brief exhalation of thin smoke issued from the bullet hole. "Sit down and discuss with me the specifics of what you've done, or I'll wreck your precious decor and then break you piece by piece in as painful a way as I can imagine. And I've got a vivid imagination." His hand still cupped to his ear, he said,
"Don't you hear the whispering, Jane? All the whispering in the whispering room? If you don't hear it yet, you soon will."
With that, he turned his back to her and walked to the open balcony doors. Following close behind him, she said, "Stop right there." Instead of obeying, he dashed across 15 feet of balcony, vaulted the decorative steel railing, and leaped into 9 stories of air, empty of all else but rain. Chapter 29. Jane arrived at the railing even as David James Michael took flight, the heels of his designer sneakers for an instant within her reach, and she expected some stunt, a quick deploying parachute, but there was no stunt. Only his diving form, arms spread in mimicry of an eagle, seeming to glide rather than plummet through the tinseled rain. Their windows blinded by the blackout, the nearer buildings brooded over the eclipsed street, where in a false dusk, The flooding of gutters could be discerned largely by necklaces of phosphorescent foam borne on the racing waters. In witness to the fall, leaning over the railing, Jane stood breathless, and it seemed as though her heart stopped as well, so that she stood in a condition of temporary death, oblivious of the chill and of the rain beating against her, no sound audible and no scent detectable, no senses functioning except the sense of sight. From the 9th floor deck to the street, through 100 feet or more of gravity's inescapable attraction, strobed by a flicker of lightning, the billionaire descended, as would have any pauper. He appeared to hit the front steps of Far Horizons head first, and tumbled down them, shattered limbs flailing so loosely that he might have been a straw-stuffed effigy of a man tossed off the 9th floor as a hoax. Jane's heart knocked hard, as though restarting with a stutter, and breath came cold and wet, and she smelled ozone cleaved from the air by lightning. Her deafness relented when a wave of city sounds broke across her, including the squeal of brakes as traffic in the street below reacted to the impact of the jumper. She holstered the pistol and turned from the railing and ran into the apartment, past the wealth of art and antiques, not to the alcove that contained DJ's private elevator, but to the steel door that opened onto the hidden stairs. She took the stairs two at a time, bounding off each landing onto the next flight, pain flaring in her wound, descending through the fluorescent glare that now seemed as bright as a police chopper's searchlight, certain that she had little time before the street in front of Far Horizons would be snarled with traffic and then sealed off by arriving authorities. At the bottom of the stairs, she pulled open the door, stepped into the maintenance closet with its shelf of cleaning supplies and sealants, where the push brooms and other janitorial tools lay on the floor as she had left them, through another door, into the garage, quickly to the BMW that belonged to Henry Waldlock, who, naked and duct-taped and zip-tied, waited for her return. She thought she had lost the keys, but she'd only forgotten in which pocket she stowed them. The gate seemed to take a long time to decouple from its electronic locks and roll aside. She followed the out-ramp to the street, switching on windshield wipers, headlights, dreading the clotted vehicles that she expected to find. A few cars were angled to the curb on each side of the street, and passing traffic slowed as drivers gawked. She avoided looking at the broken body on the steps, having already seen too many suicides, and supposed suicides. A gap in traffic allowed her to exit the driveway, cross the nearer lane, and head downhill. If it appeared to witnesses that she'd left the scene in haste, one of them might have thought to get the license number, in which case there could be an all-points bulletin issued sooner than later. She drove as fast as she dared, barrages of rain bulleting the windshield as she cruised out of the power failure into precincts where lights glowed at windows. Here, life appeared to be proceeding as usual, though all the busy people were in fact imperiled, as they in their ignorance could never know. The current storm was a mere inconvenience, but the storm of change that DJ Michael had set in motion might still be oncoming, and when it broke, it was likely to sweep away every man, woman, and child, as the billionaire himself had been swept away. Chapter 30. By the time Jane returned to Pacifica, a hard wind had followed the rain out of the northwest, blowing dead needles and cones from the pines, scarlet flowers from the flame trees, silver-blue dollar coin leaves from eucalyptuses, shakes from shingled roofs, rolling empty collection day trash containers along the streets, tumbling drained soda cans, fighting an invisible bull with a great cape of plastic torn from a construction site fence. Rather than risk driving to Henry Waldlock's Greek Revival house, she parked a block from her Explorer Sport and walked to it and used a burner phone to make a 911 call, in which she identified herself and said that the cost control analyst needed to be freed from the water closet in his master bathroom. She ventured out of the SUV and found a street drain and dropped the phone into it. With the wound in her side burning as if she had been branded, she set out on a 70-mile drive that would take her across the Golden Gate Bridge to the town of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County, to the home of Dr. Porter Walkins, who weeks earlier had treated both a badly wounded ally of hers, Dougal Traherne, and Jane herself. It was he who dressed the scratch she incurred in a confrontation with a coyote, who began treating her with human rabies immune globulin and human diploid cell vaccine. If he trusted in the innocence of his patient, Dr. Walkins would treat a gunshot wound without filing the required police report. He was the kind of man who could watch the news and separate the small grain of truth, if there was one, from the great mass of chaff. He believed in Jane after the violent events at the Schenck Ranch in Napa earlier in the month, and she hoped he would still believe in her after whatever media firestorm ensued from the death of David James Michael. By the time she reached the Golden Gate, the diminished rain needled through thick fog incoming off the ocean. The wind shaped the mist into phantom forms, which it harried west to east, as if the ghosts of countless sailors drowned at sea were returning to shore, an exodus from many thousands of watery graves in some last day's accounting of the human experience and a reckoning of its debts. Traffic crept across the great expanse of cabled red steel, the aureoled headlights of oncoming vehicles tunneling the fog. In that passage, the Pacific unseen on her left, the bay and city shrouded on her right, Jane Hawke began at last to grapple with the mystery of what had happened to DJ Michael. Cornered by 100 policemen dispatched by prosecutors with ironclad proof of his crimes against humanity, the billionaire would have done nothing more drastic than summon his attorneys and set aside $10 million for his defense. No narcissist with his enormous arrogance would admit the least wrongdoing or readily accept defeat, and he certainly would not despair to the extent of taking his life. "Do you hear destiny whispering, Jane?" When he had spoken of destiny and the whispering room, had he suggested by the cupping of his ear that he could hear microwave instructions in some receptive chamber of his own brain? Or had he meant that an entire world of people in the service of an elite caste would one day be accessible to be marshaled simultaneously for whatever task their controllers wished them to undertake? Whichever DJ Michael might have meant, it seemed clear that a faction within the Arcadians had conspired to sedate him without his knowledge and inject him with a nanotech control mechanism. In the history of revolution, no king had ever been deposed by a means more sinister than this, more intimate. Those would-be gods who had conceived this new pantheon, lacking the power of monotheism, were the residents of a modern Olympus where they not only ruled but also conspired against one another, proving themselves no more elevated than the members of a street gang contesting with knives and guns for dominion of a worn-down neighborhood or public housing project. Just north of San Pablo Bay, the fog feathered away, and Jane drove out of the rain. The sky remained low, trailing thin gray rags like grave clothes worn to tatters by the restless wandering of some cold and withered decedent whose spirit would not depart it. To her, just now, this land that was so fertile and these communities that were so vital, Novato and Petaluma and Ronert Park, looked bleak, shadowed even on this sunless day, haunted not by the dead, but by the ghosts of days to come, by the destiny that whispered to David James Michael. She understood that the reasons for her mood were many, having accumulated over nearly 5 months since Nick's death, but there was one among the many that most acutely affected her. "Don't you hear the whispering, Jane? All the whispering in the whispering room? If you don't hear it yet, you soon will." The billionaire had been confident that the day of Jane's induction into the legions of the controlled was near at hand. when she would be like unto the citizens of Iron Furnace. She found herself returning in memory to the previous night, when she'd been in Henry Waldlock's spare bedroom while he passed the evening unaware of her presence, watching some thundering movie about giant robots or whatever. She had braced the bedroom door with a straight-backed chair before daring to catch a few hours of sleep. The door had still been braced shut when she woke and went to Waldlock's room to chloroform and bind him. There was no way into that spare bedroom except through the barricaded door. The bathroom adjacent to those guest quarters had not served two bedrooms. No one could have reached her through the bath. She hadn't checked to be sure that the windows were locked. She should have checked. But it was ludicrous to suppose some villain with the skills of a cat burglar had come upon her through a window. Anyway, she had slept because she was exhausted, not because she had been sedated. The only place she could have been slipped a sedative without her knowledge was at the restaurant in Pacifica, where she'd eaten an early dinner before going to see Waldlock. But no one had known she was in town. No one could have anticipated where she would dine. Paranoia. Understandable, but dangerous. If she'd been injected, she would not have gone after DJ Michael. She would be controlled. Unless there was a new generation of control mechanism, one that took longer than a few hours to self-assemble in the brain. In Santa Rosa, she parked in a residential neighborhood, a block from her destination. The street was patinated with leaves applied to the pavement by the recent wind and rain, and the trees still dripped. Dr. Porter Walkins was that rarity among contemporary doctors, a general practitioner whose offices were attached to his residence. Jane knew he took his lunch at home, during an hour when he allowed no patient appointments, but she didn't know if that hour started at noon or 12:30. She sat in the Explorer for 20 minutes, before setting out on foot for the address he'd given her when he had treated her for possible exposure to rabies. The pain that had subsided during the drive from San Francisco burned anew with her activity. One block seemed like three. Given her bedraggled appearance and considering that her disguise had been taken from her by the shrieking ape and the rain, she was relieved when she reached the physician's house without encountering anyone. She went around to the back of the white Victorian with blue and white gingerbread, mounted the porch steps, and saw the doctor through a kitchen window. He was alone and appeared to be making a sandwich. It was 12:35 when she knocked on the door. Chapter 31. Although only 50-something, Porter Walkins had a moral code, a sense of duty, and a contempt for ideology that were better suited to a time 3/4 of a century prior to the current age, and he dressed to complement his character. Elbow patches on a tweed sport coat, white shirt with bow tie, the tie not a clip-on, gray wool pants held up with striped suspenders, highly polished wingtips, trim and fit, with a careworn and caring face out of a Norman Rockwell portrait of a country doctor, he was always of good humor. But something about him, perhaps some guarded aspect of his hazel eyes, suggested that he hid from the world a persistent melancholy. With his receptionist out to lunch, he treated Jane in his surgery. When she stripped to her underwear, he seemed not at all concerned about the 2 Heckler & Koch 45s. She stretched out on the examination table while he assessed and washed the wound, which he found more serious than she did. He applied local anesthetic and closed the bullet-torn flesh with stitches.
"They'll dissolve over time," he said. "No need to have them removed."
On a previous occasion, when she had asked him why he risked treating patients off the record, which could result in the loss of his license to practice, he had said,
"I watch the news, Mrs. Hawk,"
by which he had meant not her story specifically, but the news of a world sliding into darkness. Now, he said,
Did you give as good as you got?
Better. But not enough. Never enough. It's an uphill slog, and I'm beginning to think I'm just a flatland runner.
You're suffering exhaustion, and I believe you lost more than a pint of blood.
I've often donated a pint. A pint is nothing. As she sat up on the edge of the exam table, the doctor raised one eyebrow and said acerbically,
"My exact words were more than a pint. Because you weren't considerate enough to diligently collect the blood for my professional measurement, I think it wise that you don't self-diagnose the loss as nothing. You should rest for a couple days in a room upstairs where I can check on you from time to time."
Stay in your house?
I'm not suggesting we share a bed, Mrs. Hawk. I may look like a swinging playboy, but I assure you I'm not.
No, I'm sorry. I only meant... You can't have the country's most wanted criminal staying in your house.
Most wanted, perhaps, but I suspect not criminal.
Anyway, no offense, but if I have to rest, I'd rather rest where I can be with my boy, my son.
With a hypodermic syringe, Watkins punctured the membrane on an ampule of some drug and drew out a dose.
"What are you doing?" she demanded.
Her alarm puzzled him. "It's an antibiotic. Considering your exploits as I know them, I'm surprised you'd flinch at a needle."
"It's not the needle. But can't I take pills instead?"
"You'll also be taking pills, Mrs. Hawk. Since I have received a fine medical school education, which you have not, I suggest you say yes, doctor, and avoid the likelihood of bacteremia, toxemia, and life-threatening sepsis. And may I assume you've been self-injecting the rabies vaccine according to the schedule I gave you?"
"Yes, of course."
"Truthfully now?"
She grimaced. "Yes, mother, I have been self-injecting the rabies vaccine."
Using a length of rubber tubing as a tourniquet, he searched for a vein in her right arm, said she had excellent venal formation, swabbed her skin with alcohol, and gave her the injection.
As Jane watched the fluid leave the barrel of the syringe, she resisted a swoon, darkness encroaching at the edges of her vision. When Porter Watkins extracted the needle, she passed out, and would have fallen off the exam table on which she sat if he had not caught her in his arms. When she regained consciousness, less than a minute later, she conceded the extent of her exhaustion and, once dressed, allowed him to escort her to a room upstairs.
Chapter 32. In the 5 days since Jolie Tillman had escaped being injected with a nanotech control mechanism by her mother and sister, she'd become uncharacteristically antisocial, as if all of humankind was now suspect, and she had taken to spending most of her time with the horses. Strong as she was, the girl had been cried out in 2 days, but nevertheless grieving and depressed beyond Luther's ability to console her. He was likewise inconsolable, having lost no less than she did, and in some ways more, as Rebecca had been and always would be the one great love of his life. He knew that if either he or Jolie were to find a way forward, they would have to find it together or not at all. Their circumstance was unique, in that the loved ones they had lost were still alive, but no longer who they had once been, and were forever beyond redemption. He had shaved his head and begun to grow a beard, which was coming in more white than not, though he'd had no white in his hair. A change in appearance, however, did nothing to lift him from this low point or give him hope of a future. That Wednesday afternoon, Luther found Jolie at the railing of a fenced meadow, watching horses graze and gamble. He leaned against the railing beside her and said nothing, for he couldn't think of anything that he hadn't already said. Whether rational or not, to some extent Jolie blamed their loss on him. If he wasn't a sheriff, he wouldn't have gotten mixed up in all this craziness. If he hadn't put duty before family, he wouldn't have gone off to Iron Furnace, Kentucky. If... He blamed her not at all for her hostility. Indeed, though he knew it wasn't rational, he blamed himself. Yes. Had he stayed in Minnesota and done nothing, Rebecca and Twyla might not now be among the living dead. But he also remembered the arrogant man from the Department of Justice, Booth Hendrickson. The powerful people behind this nightmare would sooner rather than later have seen him as a loose end and would have scheduled him and his family for injections. They were at a time in history that allowed no conscientious objectors, when every man, woman, and child was either a combatant or a victim. The sky was wide and blue, the air warm, the horses spirited, the dear girl silent in her grief, unwilling to acknowledge her father's presence for almost half an hour before, at last, she reached out and put one hand on his arm. Chapter 33. When Jane woke, in bed, the digital clock on the nightstand read 5:40 p.m. Her two suitcases and tote stood unopened by the closet door. Dr. Watkins had moved her car to his garage and brought the bags upstairs. She threw back the covers and sat on the edge of the bed. In the crook of her right arm, a Band-Aid covered the point at which he'd given her an injection. She peeled it off and saw a small spot of blood on the gauze. The needle prick was hardly visible. The wound in her side ached, though not badly. Because it was covered with a wide strip of waterproof tape, she couldn't count the number of stitches. Her double-carry rig lay on the dresser, both pistols still in the holsters. She opened one of the suitcases and took out fresh clothes and laid them on the bed. Dr. Watkins had said he would prepare dinner for two at 7 o'clock. She went into the adjacent bathroom, longing for a hot shower. At the mirror, she regarded her reflection for a minute before she said, "Play Manchurian with me." After another minute, she turned on the hot water in the shower and, with pleasure, breathed in the rising cloud of steam. Chapter 34. A salad of fresh tomatoes and lettuce with shaved parmesan, a pot of spaghetti sauce on the cooktop, frozen meatballs thawed and simmering in the ragu, store-bought garlic bread toasting under the broiler, a pound of Barilla pasta churning in a pot of bubbling water. Porter Watkins was not one of those aging bachelors who developed a passion for cooking. Aside from salad, if he couldn't find it in a can or jar or in a supermarket freezer, it would never find its way into his diet. As simple as the meal might be, she found it delicious, as no doubt any condemned man spared from execution by the governor's midnight commutation would find his first meal, after his last meal, tasty. Earlier in the month, after the events at Bertold Schenck's ranch in Napa Valley, Porter Watkins had treated Dougal Traherne and Jane without being told in detail the truth of why she was wanted by the FBI and every other law enforcement agency of any consequence. Now, over wine and then over dinner, when she explained it to him, he asked intelligent and probing questions, but didn't find what she told him to any degree too fantastic for consideration. From him, she learned that Luther Tillman was now part of the Jane Hawk saga, a fixture in every cable news broadcast. His wife and daughter, Twyla, on returning to Minnesota from a short holiday, had found their house ransacked and the body of a Homeland Security agent, Huey Darnell, shot twice in the back of the head with a gun belonging to Tillman. Authorities said that Luther was in league with Jane regarding the sale of national security secrets, though how a rural sheriff might have become associated with her was not clear. The other Tillman daughter, Jolie, was missing and believed to be in mortal danger. No mention had been made of Iron Furnace. Porter evidently saw the sadness that settled on Jane at this news.
"What mortal danger do they mean?"
"It's not his daughter, Jolie, at risk," she said. "She must be with him. The only way to read it is. His wife and his other daughter have been injected. They've been implanted. They're gone. Chapter 35. The recording, made by the body camera that Jane had worn, could be played on any computer. After dinner, Porter Walkins placed his laptop on the kitchen table, and they reviewed the last minutes of David James Michael's life. As evidence, the video was of less value than she expected. The high-definition visuals were superb, but nothing had been captured of what she and DJ said. Instead of their voices, there were only the threaded oscillations of multiple electronic tones, quite like the tinnitus that she'd been aware of now and then when she had been in his grand apartment. The creepy son of a bitch had some way of triggering a masking system to screw with the audio recording, Jane said. Maybe there's no point in hating a dead man, but I hate that arrogant shit more now than before he jumped. The doctor poured more wine. It wasn't a cure for what ailed her, but it was welcome anyway. Chapter 36. The doctor's spare bedroom had a TV, and Thursday morning Jane discovered that the suicide of David James Michael was big news following the identification of his remains. She hadn't expected to be connected to his death, and she was not. They had never publicly tied her to the death of Dr. Berthold Schenick and his wife, either, because to do so would focus media attention on Schenick technology and Far Horizons. The fools who called themselves Arcadians did not want that attention, because the public might begin to wonder if all the talk of selling national security secrets was a cover for the true reason why Jane was being so urgently sought. She made the mistake of leaving the TV on too long, whereupon she saw an interview with her father, the famous pianist and not-yet-revealed wife-murderer. He was canceling his current concert tour because his daughter's infamy was drawing what he called the wrong kind of audiences, and because he did not think it right to profit from the misdeeds of this deeply troubled woman. More likely, he worried that before she was caught, she might avenge her mother and get him in the sights of a sniper's rifle. She napped in the late morning and early afternoon while Porter Walkins treated patients, but by the time they shared another dinner in his kitchen, she had decided that she could not stay even one more night. As they sat down to vegetable soup and cheese sandwiches, she said, "Schenick's dead. DJ Michael's dead. This whole thing was a two-headed serpent, and they were it. Or so I thought. By taking DJ down the way they did, they think they've brought me to a blind alley, nowhere to go from here. But all they've done is show me this snake has more than two heads. The longer I stay out of the hunt, the less likely I am to track down the identity of the third one." After dinner, in Porter Walkins's garage, when he had helped her load her luggage, as they were standing by the driver's door of her Explorer, he said, "I'd be dismayed to hear one day that I did my best doctoring only for you to be shot again, mortally this time." "That would be a disappointment to me as well." She hugged him, and he held fast to her for a long moment. When he let go of her, she glimpsed that melancholy in him that she had thought previously might be imagined. He said, "If ever you find yourself hurt bad and too far from Santa Rosa for me to be of help, you call me anyway. I'll either come to you wherever you are, or, if I can, I'll call in a favor from someone near you. Got that?"
"I do. Yes."
He frowned.
"I mean it. Don't just be saying yes to patronize me, daughter."
When he saw the word surprised her, he said,
"I'm an old fool who was a young fool, too. At least I've been consistent. Never married, though I had some fine opportunities. Looked at the world going to hell and thought I never wanted to be responsible for bringing a child into it. Time goes by, and here I am, no child and no wife and no prospects that encourage me.
but if I had led a different life, I think I would have done the best any man could just by bringing one like you into the world.
She hadn't often been left speechless, and perhaps never before had she been at such a moment when she knew no words that she spoke could do anything but diminish the power of what had just been said. She hugged him again, held him as fiercely as he held her, and then she got behind the wheel of the Explorer, and he put up the garage door, and she drove away from there. Chapter 37. That Thursday night, when she reached the Golden Gate Bridge, no fog enshrouded that magnificent structure. The vast sea lay in blackness to the right, but for the lights of ships in transit from ports half a world away, and the lights of Berkeley and Oakland lay far to the east, beyond the storied bay, the illuminated hills like some fairyland. In that moment, Jane found it difficult to believe that there were those who despised the works of humanity, and even humanity itself, not just the Arcadians, but so many others, who in their misanthropy longed to undo all that had been built through the millennia of human struggle and striving, and even some who thought the world would be a better place if humankind had never existed. If one such had been with her now, she might have said, "Damn it, there is no world if there is not a human eye to see it. No world of any purpose or meaning. No world of more importance than is any barren planet now circling a burnt-out sun. The world can't see itself and marvel at its wonders. The mystery of consciousness makes reality, and there is no reality without a fully conscious species to apprehend it. You think the world precious because you're here to see it. We are the world, and the world is us. And neither can be but a dream of no importance without the other." And then again, she might say no such thing. For life seemed to be teaching her that she was not meant to move the world with words, that she was meant to act, to fight, as long as she remembered for what she was fighting. She thought of Luther and Jolie, of Dougal Traherne, of Ansel and Clare, of Nadine and Leland Sackett. She thought of the children of Iron Furnace, of Bernie Rigowitz, and the photo of Miriam that she now carried on her. She thought of Sandra Termindale and her daughters, Holly and Lauren, in their motorhome. And she knew why she should keep going, and why, in fact, there was no other option, short of death. Later, she pulled into a truck stop south of Salinas, the center of such rich farmland that the town called itself the Salad Bowl of the World. She parked in a far corner of that big roadside complex, away from most of its bright lights, so that she could see the stars. She got out of the Explorer. She used a disposable phone to call Jessica and Gavin Washington, guardians of her sweet child, to tell them that, having slept part of the day, she was driving all night to get there. After she switched off the cell phone, she stood gazing at the stars, the light of uncountable suns around some of which orbited worlds unknowable, 14 billion years of expansion from the Big Bang, the perimeter of the universe moving ever outward into a void the mind could not fully comprehend, all those trillions of stars so distant that none could ever be visited except in fantasy. Yet here she stood, one small life in all the immensity of the cosmos, one creature who thought and loved and needed to be loved, who could be destroyed but not defeated. She could die only because she was first alive, and therefore death, too, was a gift. She got back into the Explorer and drove south to her son, to her life, and whatever it might bring. The End.
This book was read for you by Elizabeth Rogers, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Whispering Room, a Jane Hawke novel, by Dean Koontz. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.